Hello, and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We are here with Pivardi K. Tyler. This is Renee, and I am drinking a Grimbergen Abbey Beer Blonde Ale. I think I said it right. It's delicious. It's something that my husband just found in a gas station, and we've bought a lot of it since then. Pivardi is the author of a lot of books, to name a few. Shadow on the Wall, Two Moons of Sarah, Consumed by Love, White Chalk, and the upcoming Sugar and Salt and Devour. Pivardi, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I am doing fabulous. It is so great to be here talking to you guys. And I am drinking a raspberry vodka with cranberry pomegranate juice with a lime in it that my lovely husband made for me.
That sounds amazing.
That sounds awesome.
It's like candy.
Yeah. I get in so much trouble with those.
Yeah.
Regularly, actually. So.
So what are you drinking this week, Jessica? Are we still rolling? Like, are you still clinging to the pumpkin beer?
I'm still clinging to my pumpkin beer. I saw the first case of the winter seasonal of Blue Moon, so I know that the pumpkin ale is going to be gone soon. So
I love their pumpkin beer.
I saw pumpkin soda the other day at Wegmans. So
really?
Yeah, it was kind of upsetting to me. But if you like pumpkin beer, maybe that's what you should look for next time.
Oh, see, that doesn't sound good. I don't know why. Well, stuff goes too fast. I'm deeply disturbed. I like Coke for my soda, and that's about it. Okay.
Already off topic. That's what you get when you invite Pivardi Tyler to your show. We will be off topic within the first 30 seconds.
That's okay.
That's great.
I feel like that's a good thing. Go ahead, Renee.
So, Shadow on the Wall won a lot of awards, and I'm looking at them, and I feel like it's a lot. So, I have not read Shadow on the Wall. I was hoping that you could give us a little bit of, like, let our readers know what it's about, what they're going to be getting into with it. Because, I mean, it's a finalist in the multicultural fiction category of the International Books Award. It is a winner of the general fiction novel category of the Next Generation Indie Books Award. So there's a lot of stuff happening, I feel like.
Yeah,
a lot
definitely.
Of different.
Shadow is a Muslim superhero novel.
Oh.
Which is not something that we hear about very often, but it is a Muslim superhero novel. It is loosely in homage to Batman. In fact, it's set in a city in Turkey called Ila, Turkey. Ila is the Kurdish name for a city that in modern-day Turkey is known as Batman, which is spelled exactly like Batman. So when I started writing a superhero story, how could I not set it in Batman Turkey?
Right.
That's pretty cool, yeah.
it's a Muslim story, but it is not haram, or it is haram. It is definitely written for Western audiences, for an American audience primarily. And the thing that I was most excited about playing with in it is the superhero is Muslim, but the bad guys are the religious police. So I was interested in kind of addressing the issue of whether you listen to the voice of those in religious power or whether you listen to that internal voice of God. And that's really the thing that the main character of Shadow struggles with, is when he knows what's right and wrong, whether or not he'll act on it. And to have a Muslim bad guy as well as a Muslim hero, I thought was an important dynamic to make sure that it wasn't a commentary on the religion. It was a commentary on what people do with their religion.
Right. Did you see the announcement? I think it came out today. I read it today, that the reboot of Ms. Marvel is going to be a Pakistani Muslim.
Yes, I did see that, which is pretty fantastic. Following right in line after what was her name? The Super Burka Girl, the superhero. And then there's also the 99, which I don't know if you're familiar with. It's an online comic done by Dr. Naif, and it is 99 superheroes set in Saudi Arabia. It's a pretty fantastic comic series.
Oh, wow, cool. I'm just going to check that out.
Yeah, definitely. He's a really fabulous person and has some really wonderful things to say about equality and what makes religion powerful in an individual's life, regardless of what religion you subscribe to.
So when starting in on Shadows or on Shadow, what was the research like for that? Because I have to imagine it was like intense, like serious.
It was very intense. I have to admit that I was very interested in Islam and Hinduism for probably a decade before I finally sat down and wrote this novel. So I had already read the Quran by the time I started. I had studied some rudimentary Arabic and read quite a bit of Middle Eastern fiction, a lot of Salman Rushdie, a lot of Vikram Seth, and various other titles from that part of the world. So when I was ready to sit down and kind of explore this idea I had in my head, I was able to just research the things that I was specifically interested in. I already knew the difference between a burqa and a hijab. So I didn't have to do some of the more basic research when I started writing it, which definitely made it faster.
Yeah. And so I guess my question, you seem to write in, well, I don't know, I would say a lot of different genres because it sounds kind of weird, but Shadow is definitely specifically like it, what, you know, a more mainstream sort of novel. I guess maybe.
I don't know. I call it literary fiction. It's magical realism, but it is very dark, as most good superhero novels will be, and I certainly hope that this one qualifies as good. But it is dark. There are some pretty extreme depictions of violence. So I certainly don't want anybody to go into it thinking they're going to read a nice Spider-Man romp.
Right.
Okay.
But I do refer to myself as a genre bender.
Yeah,
literary fiction is probably my main pull. I think that everything I have has some of the elements of what defines literary fiction. But, you know, I've done fantasy, I've done romance, I've done contemporary. Right now I'm playing with a sci-fi project. I try to write what's exciting to me, because I figure the more exciting it is to me, the more exciting it's going to be to my readers.
Yeah. Which leads me to something else. I was really interested in it. Your blog is amazing, by the way, and we'll link it up for the listeners to check out. There is a lot of different stuff going on this blog. I really did get like down the rabbit hole today a little bit, and I had to kind of pull back and be like, okay, what specifically am I going to take notes on? Because obviously I can't talk about the entire blog. So in addition to a lot of book reviews and so a lot of things about like femininity and womanhood, which I thought were interesting, you have a series on how to write porn. That's what it's called, How to Write Porn. I didn't make that up. I'm not, you know. One of the things that I thought was interesting is you made the point that just because somebody writes something in an erotica story or novel doesn't mean that that's like what they're into. But at the same time, if it's something that you're so not into and you try to write it in, that it's going to be really obvious to the reader and it's going to come across as flat. And I was wondering if you could clarify that a little bit for the listeners. I think it's interesting, like that line between, I'm going to write what turns me on, or I'm going to find an angle about this thing I want to write about that can get me titillated enough to get it on paper and make it good.
I think that any kind of fiction has a grain of truth in it. Anything you write, you have a certain amount of the author exposed to the reader. That's why it's so, you know, terrifying to publish a book, because you're putting out a little piece of yourself for people to look at and judge. And in erotica, it's even more terrifying because if you write something really transgressive, if you write something that's really pushing the boundaries of what's acceptable, a lot of people are going to come away from that and think automatically, oh, well, she likes to have, you know, sex with horses. Now, just because you wrote that doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you like.
Right.
But there has to be a seed of something that fascinates you in it. You know, if you personally find the idea of that so repulsive that you can't even have a conversation about it, that's going to come across in your writing. So I think it's important in erotica to be able to write about something that even if it doesn't personally turn you on, you are excited by what it is you're representing, what it is you are exploring in your writing.
Yeah. And I think, and I'm going to jump around a lot on this episode because we have so much to talk about. So hopefully our listeners at home are not thinking that I've lost my mind, because usually we do like 5 minutes on this, 10 minutes on that. But I wanted to talk about white chalk because I feel like what you said sort of is a nice segue into that. It's definitely a transgressive story. And I liked what you said about, the premise of the book is it's a romance between a 13-year-old girl, or a sexual relationship between a 13-year-old girl and an adult man. And so what I thought was interesting, you said that, it is titillating. It's titillating on purpose, but the reason is because by titillating the reader, then they have to sort of face that, what that means. And they have to really stop and think about the story and what their preconceived notions about it are and how they're reacting and everything like that.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I've said about white chalk in a couple of interviews is that white chalk is not about me. This is not my story. It's not autobiographical, but it could have been. And for people who've read the story, that can be horrifying to hear, but it only takes a small push to change the trajectory of a life when you are a young girl in America. And I think that's, you know, young boys, and I think it's every country, but having grown up female in America, from the sexual pressures, from the pressure to grow up, from the assumption that we should be able to take care of ourselves as well as take care of other people. Being a woman in this culture isn't easy, and being a young girl trying to figure out how to be a woman in this culture is cripplingly difficult. So, you know, in my life, I had a mother who was extremely supportive, a father who was attentive, and I had great teachers, and one teacher in particular who took interest in me and really pushed me to do better. How much would my life change if you changed one of those factors? And then in the story in White Chalk, Michelle's story, what if you twist all those factors just a little bit? And the direction that a life can take just with those small changes really is dramatic.
I think it's a really interesting point to make, because I think a lot of times in the real world, when we see a situation that's really bad, whether, you know, what we see a lot, unfortunately, if it's a rape victim or it's somebody that's in a really awful situation, is we come up with reasons why that wouldn't happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a security blanket where you tell yourself that bad things happen to people who make bad decisions, and you don't necessarily acknowledge that actually there are things that are outside of your control that could lead your child to be involved in something like this, or that could put you in that situation. And I think it's really interesting that you bring it up, that it doesn't take much to really screw somebody's life up.
One of the things that I enjoyed playing with in White Chalk that I think is the point that made so many people uncomfortable with the story, and I'm fine with that. I mean, it certainly wasn't written as a rom-com. It is an uncomfortable story. But one of the things that I really enjoyed playing with was Shell has a relationship. She's 13 years old, and she has a relationship with her history teacher, Mr. Harris. And for most of the story, this absolutely inappropriate and abusive relationship that she's in with an older man gives her a sense of self and pride and strength. In some ways, it's a good thing for her. And we don't want to say that, and we don't want to see it, but she finds an identity there. Granted, it's an abusive and damaging identity, but she finds some strength there that otherwise she doesn't have in any other aspect of her life. So when that relationship is taken away from her, she's utterly destroyed.
Sorry.
It gives me chills.
And
what makes people most uncomfortable is that you know that that's not, I mean, this is fiction, but that general story is not fiction.
Right. No, actually, a week after White Chalk was released, I received a couple of reviews about how, you know, I'd only written this book for shock value, and the fact that Shell was 13 was completely unrealistic, and I couldn't possibly be representative, and I should be ashamed of myself for exploiting, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that very same week, a news article came out about a girl who committed suicide after having her relationship with her teacher. She was 13. Her relationship with her teacher was discovered and publicized in the local newspaper. The teacher in question was taken to court, and the judge said, well, she was mature enough to know what she did, even if she was underage, and gave him one day in jail as punishment.
Yeah, I remember that story quite well.
Yeah, it was very upsetting, but very timely. So, you know, it may not be comfortable to talk about, and we don't want to necessarily have these conversations with our children when they're 10, 11, 12, but that's what we need to.
Completely. I remember when I was in school hearing, you know, the stories of, well, that teacher, you know, the young teacher, whoever, you know, he had some girls over at his house and this and that. And it wasn't, you know, it was the 13, 14, 15-year-old girls.
Sure. And I remember it quite well. I remember the things I was doing at that age. And it was not all, you know, My Little Pony and roses. And I have a daughter who's 13, who's 10, growing on 35. So
yeah. And so life is, you don't sleep well, I imagine.
Yeah. I actually sleep better than other people probably do because I just talk to her about it. I'm not particularly squeamish about these things with my children. So they're probably more horrified than I am.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I have a daughter as well. She's much younger. But I think it's one of those things that you have to kind of get over it. I remember that somebody like got really freaked out when I said something about the plan that we have for when our daughter is older to have like a box that we can't see into that we can drop condoms in intermittently and she can take them or not take them and we won't know. And they were like, ooh,
that's what my mother did.
So inappropriate. And I'm like, AIDS is like a real thing. I would rather be the weird parent than have my kid get AIDS. Like,
yep, absolutely. That is exactly what my mother did.
Mm-hmm. So
I didn't end up with, you know, being pregnant or sick at a young age. So I'm quite thankful for my mother's forthrightness. Both my mother and my stepmother are nurses, so they're very matter-of-fact people when it comes to things like sex, which is probably why, you know, I'm more drawn to the stories that are a little uncomfortable because the, you know, will she, won't she romance idea doesn't really appeal to me. It seems very, very done. So I really enjoy both reading and writing and watching movies that are go a little bit deeper.
I think that's a good point to make too, because like you say, it's been done and there's a, you know, there's a market for it. And I'll admit that on occasion I will pop in, one of the classic rom-coms, if you will, because I feel like
I'm a big fan of the Black Dagger Brotherhood. Don't get me wrong. A good formulaic romance.
Yeah,
I can absolutely be what you're looking for.
Right. But also, there's so much more there. And I think, too, where we're at as a society, like, things are changing, however slowly. that it's not unrealistic that you're going to encounter a woman that doesn't want to deal with that kind of bullshit. Or that realizes if you are having some kind of issue every other week that you probably are not going to live happily ever after when you finally decide, you know, whatever.
You can't fix anyone. I mean, and I know that it's so cliche. I mean, I think it's like a Dr. Phil quote, but the only person you really have the control over changing who they are is you. You can't influence other people's actions. You can just be an example, and you can only really take care of yourself. And that doesn't mean to live selfishly or in a bubble, but it does mean that at a certain point, you can't fix other people. They have to want to be fixed. And there are so many stories in the romance and erotica genres where there are these broken men, and then, you know, they mistreat the woman, and she puts up with it because she can save him, and she sees the good in him, and then he comes around, and then they're happily ever after. And that is absolutely a fairy tale. It's a great fairy tale. We all like to read it sometimes, but real life doesn't work that way, and I guess I'm a little too jaded.
Yeah, well, and it's just, you know, if you break down some of the really super popular romantic stories that are out there, like Twilight, that's really weird. Like, that relationship is unhealthy. And the way it ends is, like, literally unhealthy because now she's technically dead.
Now, I don't know if you guys know this, but I got my start in writing by writing Twilight fan fiction.
Really?
You know, I've been writing for years, but that's when I really started, like, sitting down and writing every day, was writing Twilight fan fiction. And it absolutely was. I read those books, and I got about halfway through Breaking Dawn, and when Jacob imprinted on the goddamn baby, I threw my book across the room and scared my dog. And
yeah.
I started writing fan fiction to fix the books.
That's hilarious. Because at first I was like, oh, great. I was, like, talking shit about Twilight, and she's like, oh, no, they're really great. And you're like, no, they were so wrong that I had to do something about it.
You know, but on the other hand, they are really great. They really do touch on something. There's a reason why so many of us got excited about those books. There's something very basic and archetypal about it. But on the other hand, like, I just got so frustrated.
the second interesting that Twilight fan fiction comes up, because the second example I was going to give, everybody, I'm sure, has either read it or read parts of it, excerpts on the internet, made fun of it, whatever.
Master of the Universe.
Shades of Grey.
I wish.
No, but again, it's exactly what you were saying, that this guy, he is super, super fucked up. And he has, like, a good excuse, which, whatever. And it's this whole thing of, like, you know, my mother was a crack whore. Like, how many people just say that all the time? Like,
well, and,
you know,
it also
you're
goes
definitely
back to the point you're making.
Go ahead.
It just goes back to the point you were making about erotica, about how you write erotica, you have to write about things that, if they don't titillate you, at least they excite your imagination and your mind. But there's also a certain point where you actually have to know what you're talking about. And, you know, I know the BDSM community has been furious about Fifty Shades of Grey because it's not an accurate portrayal of that lifestyle. And it's actually, there's direct lines of the number of people who've gotten hurt because they're not playing safely or appropriately.
Right.
Right.
I have heard that there was a whole just outrage of people who are actually, you know, doing that and that sort of thing. Lovely for them. And just really upset that this is portraying, like, this is that lifestyle, and it absolutely is not. And you have to.
Well, it's because the relationship in those books has an element of abuse. And a true BDSM relationship is about trust and security and safety. And it's not abusive, even though from the outside people might make that mistake. Whereas, you know, the behavior in those books is just not healthy.
Right. And especially if your, like, go-to reason why you're a dick is that your mother was a crack whore. I'm sorry. It's just really weird to me that that was like where E.L. James went, and that it was like a recurring line that had to happen. Well, my mother was a crack whore. It's like, can't you just say that she, I mean, sometimes could you be like, she was a bitch, or she was a terrible mother, or
she was an addictive
prostitute,
even? Something.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like,
I just realized, because I was going to bring up one of our past guests that was in to the dominatrix stuff and did that professionally, and then I realized that we've had two past guests that have been professional dominatrixes.
Yes.
Dominatrixes. Is that how you say that?
Dominatrixes.
Yeah.
Dominatrixi.
So now I'm starting to wonder about our show a little bit, but no, that's neat.
We have Ruth Rand, Krista Faust.
And Krista Faust, yeah. But I was going to mention Ruth. She always talked about it was absolutely, it's not angry. You know, you're not supposed to be doing these things in anger. It's you enjoy it.
That's supposed to be fun. Yeah, if it's not fun, then you should be doing something else, because the point of sex is to have fun.
Right, and the BDSM lifestyle, much like many of the fetish lifestyles, there's a need that needs to be fulfilled that sometimes other people don't understand, but it feeds the people who are involved in it in a way that is healthy. The act itself, looking at it from the outside, might not seem that way, but for the person partaking in it on the inside, that is what they need, and they're finding fulfillment with the other person, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. You had, speaking of needs, you had a How to Write Porn post called Cumulation, and I thought it was hilarious because you're pointing out, like, okay, it's erotica, or it's an erotic romance, or even, and this is, you know, maybe even more so in different genres that, like, we'll throw a sex scene in, that there's all this talk about what's happening before, and maybe even you're going into detail about the actual act of sex, and then, like, nobody actually comes. It's just sort of like, and then it was over. So,
well, there's that, and then there's the other side of it, which I don't know. I mean, good Lord, if I read one more story where somebody feels his orgasm inside their womb, that's
right.
Not possible. You don't feel it there. You're doing something wrong. You need to go get tested for what object you've got lodged up there if you feel it in your womb.
If there is one word that could make me immediately be like, ooh, I don't feel sexy, is it is like
womb?
Womb. Yeah, like, really, because
or
I know
I have
that
to
when
say
I was,
the word ejaculate. Ejaculate is also not.
That's pretty bad.
Cool.
But when I'm trying to get in the mood, I don't want to think about being 8 months pregnant. But when I think about my womb, that's what I think about. So I'm just saying, shout out to anybody who might be listening. Don't use that word. Speaking of words, this is the one that made me fall in love with you, figuratively speaking, because I didn't know you at the time.
Of course, but now you can love me for real, because we've officially met in a virtual way.
In your post-vaginal vernacular, which, by the way, I've read so many blog posts about what to call a vagina, because it is like, it's really tough to figure it out. And I love that you were like, just don't say pussy. Because I cannot, if I am reading something and I hit that word, or if I'm trying to write and I get to the point where, like, maybe I'm supposed to use that word, like, I just stop and I make a face.
Well, I think it sounds like some kind of festering boil, personally.
Right.
That double S-E sound, it's just not attractive to me.
How
I do use
pussy?
It sometimes. Yeah, and I know a lot of people prefer it. And I think that for me it comes down to, you know, I went to Smith College. I've got that, you know, old world feminist education in me. And would you rather be called a pussy or a cunt? Which would you rather be? Do you want to be something soft and weak and pliant and oozy, or do you want to be something hard and sharp that stands up for themselves and maybe is a little bit off-putting, but that can do its own thing?
And
I'd rather be a cunt.
Pussy just sounds so juvenile. It's like it's what preteen boys call each other because they're confused about their masculinity. It's not,
well, and
you know,
think about how,
like,
they're used as insults. If a man is called a pussy, it means that he's weak or he's less than. If a man is called a cunt, it means he's being difficult or too demanding. Again, which would you rather be?
Yeah, well, and you don't hear children experimenting with calling each other cunts. I mean, maybe you hear that in England. I'll have to ask my husband, but I don't think you do. But you hear children say pussy, and you hear children giggle about pussy. And so when I see that word, I'm like, it's juvenile, it's kind of gross. And but then you have to have something, because I was just ranting, like screaming at my poor husband in the middle of the night, because I write at night. I was like, if it's erotica, all these blog posts will say something like, well, you just avoid it. Because some people really don't like the word pussy, and some people really don't like the word cunt, and all the rest of them are actually
offensive. I would rather you use pussy than use, you know, her hidden pearl. Like, use
right?
a word, a real word. And
to me,
there are a lot of words out there. I think I would rather somebody use, actually, I know, I would rather somebody use a word that I personally wouldn't choose to use than be overly medical about it. I have read ones where they're like, the outer vaginal lips are enlarged with, and I'm like, oh, good God.
But what pissed me off is because if you're reading erotica, or you're reading a romance or erotic romance, you are probably a woman, and you know that you are there. The reason you're sitting there with that book in your hand is to get off. Maybe just turn yourself on enough that you could go take care of business with your significant other. But either way, the point is that you are reading that because after you're done reading it, something is going to happen with your vagina. Like, nobody just
some
reads
hot water.
Yeah, like, you're not just going to be like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to sit on the beach and read. No, like, there's
see,
a purpose.
See, no, this you don't know me that well. I've got to say, I was in Toronto a couple of weeks ago visiting a friend of mine, and I sat down next to their erotica section in a chain bookstore that they have. And, you know, I flipped through most of them, and I read a page here and I read a page there, and I stumbled on one, and I read five pages, and I was like, good God, this is dirty. But it's rare that a book can really strike me as dirty. So I flipped ahead and read another, like, two pages. Good God. So I had to buy this book, anything that can get me. It's called Triptych. It's fabulous. There's octopus sex.
Wow.
It is the most transgressive thing I think I've ever read. I don't know how it passed the censors. It's on Amazon, which, you know, is against all of their rules. Clearly, they don't bother checking the traditionally published books.
Oh, my God.
This has incest. It has bestiality. It has everything in it. So I read it on the bus from Toronto back to
I know. Well, okay.
Oh, man.
So what I was going to say is that, you know, women know that they, because I'm going to come back to that. Women know that they have vaginas. Like, every woman I've ever met is aware of it. Right?
I am.
But they tell you, you read these blogs and you read these articles, and they're like, just avoid it. And I'm like, why? They know it's there. They know that that's what his hard cock is going
into. It's another level of shaming us. You know, it's okay to read these books to get titillated, but it's not okay to actually fulfill that titillation. It's okay to talk about the concepts, but it's not okay to actually know, understand, and embrace your own body. It's just yet another layer of paternalism.
But exactly, because we can talk about the man's body and the man's sexual organs and all of that, but we only refer to the woman's body in what is being done to it. Because we can't say a word, we can't say cunt or pussy or vag or whatever your preferred word is, because some people don't like those words. It's like, well, they need to either get over it or get over it, because
exactly.
you know you have one. And the woman could actually, she's allowed to do things to the man. Her body shouldn't only be referred to as what is happening to it.
Yeah, we are not receptacles. We can be active parties.
Yeah, it skeeves me out, and it made me so angry. And all it was this all started because I got to a point where I needed to say vagina, and I didn't want to say vagina. And then I got sucked in this rabbit hole, and I was just outraged for days. So, but I did read a really fantastic erotic romance on my Kindle in the car with my husband and brother once, because I didn't have anything else to read, and I was like, yeah, fuck it. I can feel like my face.
You're shifting back and forth in your seat.
Yeah, my face is so like red.
You got the seam of your jeans right in the right spot. I know where you're going.
It's like they have to know that I'm not just reading the new Stephen King.
Oh, they know.
I'm sensing the vibe. Yeah.
And for anybody who's wondering, the book was Sex and Death in the American Novel by Sarah Martinez, which I think is
a really great
book.
Fabulous book. I don't know if you've read my review of it, which is on my blog.
I haven't.
It is
I will.
I highly recommend people check it out. Sarah is very talented.
I told you.
It is actual literary erotica. It's not just, you know, wham, bam, he said, she said. It's actually very good quality.
I see. I knew that we're on this little, I don't know, I've had a lot of beer, but we're on the same wavelength here. That's the word I was trying to find. We're on the same wavelength. I loved that book because not only did it have a really great story and it got into all these things that didn't really have anything to do with the romantic relationship, but had to do with that character. You got to know her. She wasn't a slot that you were supposed to put yourself in. And also, the sex was insane.
It was
not
super hot. And I also really liked the way she used her intelligence. I mean, very rarely do you read books that are quoting Henry Miller and are discussing other literary erotica from, you know, the hailed past of censorship. She really delved into the story, and I want to read the story that her character wrote. I think that she had some really awesome and transgressive ideas filtered in through this book.
Yeah. So I loved it. And it's funny, I got it. She is like doing a promotion, giving it away for free on Kindle months ago, maybe even over a year ago. And I downloaded it not knowing what it was. And I opened it and was like, oh, this is literally about sex. And I moved on to something else, and then I ended up reading it because I didn't have anything else that I hadn't read on my Kindle, and fell in love with it. So, we are running short on time.
Are we really?
We are.
We always do this.
We've got a little bit. I mean, we got a little bit of time left, but you wrote. Because I feel like this relates. You wrote a fantastic piece on the difference between erotica, romance, erotic romance, and transgressive fiction. And you mentioned people like Henry Miller, and he came up in the last discussion. And you talked about literary erotica and transgressive fiction. And I kind of want to dig into that because I think it's amazing. I know so many people that say, when they read Tropic of Cancer, it was the first time that they read about sex explicitly. It was the first time that that something like that was put in front of them. Some people are like, it's the first time I was turned on. You know, there's a lot of stuff about that book. And I didn't read it until a couple years ago because, I don't know, just didn't get around to it. But Henry Miller is a respected writer. You know, people in his time were banning his book because it was lewd, but we recognize him as a literary great. You know, and you talked about de Sade and a lot of famous names that people, even if they've never read the work, recognize. You've seen a quote by Anais Nin, even if you've never read anything
and one
that
of
he
the,
wrote.
One of the interesting things, just to interject is that Nin and Miller were both self-published and then picked up. Miller, which is decidedly dirtier than Nin.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, one of my favorite quotes of Miller's is, "There's nothing like fucking a woman who's crying."
Yeah.
The violence, self-deprecation, misogyny. I mean, it was just over the top in every way. And it's a beautiful depiction of the time. It's a beautiful depiction of the kind of masculinity gone awry. But he's so over the top dirty. And Nin, who is also very dirty, but is more transgressive because she's challenging people's ideas of sexuality. Nin is considered erotica or porn and was never able to be picked up by a big house. She had to start her own publishing company. Whereas Miller is considered a literary classic. And it's because
Ooh.
He's a man.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's no doubt about it.
Because there's nothing especially earth-shattering, life-changing about reading about his buddy who, like, kept a douchebag on the pole of his four-poster bed so he could, like, wash the hookers out.
Yep, yep.
Like, nobody read that and was like,
that's literally,
my life has changed. I'm going to go lead a better life now. It's everything.
Whereas
I've been waiting for that.
As a woman, as a girl, the first time I read Nin, as much as she's a crazy person, it was life-changing. It was completely new to think that not only could she be in control of her life and her body and her sexuality, but that she could make it up.
Yeah.
She could live her fantasy, and there was nothing wrong with that, and there was nobody who could stop her. That was a total mindfuck.
Yeah.
And another aside, just so that, you know, because I'm full of quirky little facts. Like I said before, I went to Smith College. Anais Nin is the only woman who has ever been booed off the stage at Smith, which is a notorious feminist university.
Yeah, I think it's funny how feminism goes through, like, these weird waves of, like, it's sex is great and awesome, and you can take charge of your sexuality, and that is feminist. And then it's like, oh, don't, why all you talk about is sex? And then it goes, like, back and forth and back and forth, and you can see it intertwined through through history. I remember that somebody was very angry with me because I said, at the time, the original Playboy models and Playmates could very well have felt extremely empowered, and being able to be free and naked and be admired for that at the time was something that was relatively new, and a woman being able to do it because she wanted to and she liked it was something that you just didn't hear about. Like maybe Betty Page.
Mm-hmm.
But in the mainstream focus of the world, Playboy was something really outstandingly different. Even magazines like Hustler, they were focused more on, like, this is dirty stuff. But Playboy always had short stories and regular articles and then, like, beautiful women that really wanted to be there and were excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
But don't ever say that Playboy could have played any role in feminism, because people will try to kill you if you say that.
Well, anybody who reads Sugar and Salt will get a little bit of my politics in there, but I am, much to the chagrin of many people, I am pro-pornography. I am pro-prostitution. I think that all of these things should be legalized and regulated so that people are healthy and empowered. I think the problem is that folks are taken advantage of. But the reality is that we've been selling sex since we figured out how. Women have been using sex to control the world since the beginning of time. Madame Mao was in charge. Not her husband, not Chairman Mao, Madame Mao. Because she was the one who knew how to use sex. It was her idea to go through many of the changes that happened in China. And people don't realize that. And we have been leveraging our sexuality for power since the beginning of time. It's not new. It's not special. It's not earth-shattering. what is wrong with letting it be a commodity? The problem is that it's not safe or healthy, that people, it ends up with a drug addiction or doing it for the wrong reasons or dependent on someone who mistreats you. In a regulated, safe, healthy environment, who's to say we can't do whatever the fuck we want?
What's really interesting is when we had Krista Faust on, she talked about how she was one of the ones that was a professional dominatrix. She worked in peep booths in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about, it was great. She no regrets, no whatever. It was wonderful. But of course, there are other people who get into it for the wrong reasons or are kept there for the wrong reasons. But an interesting parallel that she made was that this selling your body, not necessarily sex, but selling your body because of poverty, it's something that happens to men and women. Women might go into the sex trade, but men go into things like fighting and underground fights and MMA. And she made a good point that we're very concerned about prostitution, sex trade. But, like, do we ever really talk about how what poverty drives men to do if they're – and I should mention that I'm former military, so this is not a statement on how I feel about the military. If you're poor and you don't have a lot of opportunities and you're an 18-year-old man, you might join the military even though you don't want to because it will put food in your mouth.
Absolutely. And it could offer you a very secure, very – not necessarily very lucrative, but a stable economic future.
Right.
And again, it's not necessarily a bad thing. The question is, how are people treated once they're there?
Right. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was interesting. So she was going on an interesting tangent about what consent really means, because we're forced into a lot of decisions in our life dependent on circumstances. And so I thought it was an interesting way of viewing it. We definitely want to talk more about Sugar and Salt, you brought it up, and we want to talk about Devour because they're coming out. We want our listeners to know what to look forward to. We got like 6 minutes left. So if you want to quickly
go.
Yeah.
Sugar and Salt. And now that's coming out in December, right?
Yes, December 2nd. Sugar and Salt will be out December 2nd. It is about 40,000 words. It's the first novella in a series of novellas. They're all based around the men and women who work at the Sugar House brothel in New York City.
Oh.
So they're kind of noir. They're erotic romance series. The first one, Sugar and Salt, is about Janice Kane, who runs the Sugar House. She is the madam and a former prostitute, although she no longer does that. And it's she is lonely. She runs her business. She's very happy with what she does. She's very successful, but is not able to have a relationship. And so she finds herself going to speed dating.
Ooh.
For companionship for the night here and there, to scratch an itch. She doesn't really want to get too involved with anyone. But one night she goes and she meets someone who, certainly excites her body, but also kind of captures her imagination. Somebody who doesn't just pander to her, somebody who is witty and has a quick repartee with her and that she can't stop thinking about. So it's about the two of them and their difficulties in trying to figure out how to have a relationship with what she does for a living, and later you find out what he does for a living and the complications that causes.
Ah. Well, now I'm interested.
And then book two is about a man who had – that will be coming out probably in March of 2014. It's about a woman who had been a former Russian sex slave and the man who freed her from that. The third one is about a dominatrix who falls in love with a dom.
Ooh.
So, the series will continue, and hopefully they'll keep getting dirtier and dirtier.
Yeah. Well, I actually know a real-life couple that was a dominatrix and a dom.
Really?
And it just blew my mind. I was like, I don't really understand how you guys make that work, but hey.
Yeah, it's a tough dynamic, but, love dictates. Sometimes you don't get a choice.
And Devour.
Devour is something – it was actually the first novel that I wrote long before I even wrote Shadow on the Wall. And I've written the first, like, 20,000 words probably 6 times, and I just can't seem to get it right. So at this point, I'm not really sure what's happening.
Forget I brought it up. Forget I said it.
Yeah, let's just drop that one. Someday it'll come out, and people will be like, didn't you already write that?
And I just wanted to mention, because I learned this in the pre-show, that as time goes on, your full catalog is going to be re-released through Evolved Publishing.
Yes.
That's awesome. So if you read the stuff that's available now, listeners at home, and you love it, there is going to be so much more. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
I'm
a busy bee. This is what I do. This is my job. This is my daytime, my nighttime. You know, I've got 2 kids, but other than that, I'm writing. I'm hustling, and I love it. I'm so blessed to be able to do what I do.
Yeah, absolutely. This was a super good show, and I want to thank you for coming on. And Jessica, remind me who it was that recommended POV to us, because I want to thank them as well.
Jessica McHugh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it was
the lovely McHugh who sent me your way.
Yeah.
I am also madly in love with her, so it makes total sense.
She's fabulous. Sense. And, you know, she also has a series with Evolved now.
Huh. I didn't know.
So it's a nice little publishing company that I'm with. I'm very happy.
I did know that she is releasing a book with a publishing company that's run by someone I know. So that was exciting. I was like, oh, my two friends are like doing a thing together. That was cool. by the way, if anyone's interested, that is Green Kangaroos. That's going to be coming out with Perpetual Motion Machine Publishing. Next week, we're going to be with Scott McClanahan.
Supposedly.
Supposedly, unless he cancels on us.
This is the second time we've said that.
Yeah. I'm sure it'll be fine. And then I'm going to... Then I don't know who's coming on after that, because Jessica hasn't updated the calendar, so look forward to Scott. And thanks for joining us this week. And we're going to do what we always do. We're going to play a song. So listen to the song, drink your drink, click all the links, and buy the books that are interesting to you, and hopefully you get excited literally and or figuratively by what you find. And we'll see you guys next week.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank
you.
I fancy. They can take my Florida shit to New York. He has New Orleans, was to a story. Her love's on nothing else. She's the queen of homeland. He's got power and flame, but she ignites the whole thing. Why fancy? Why fancy? They can take my Florida. They can't take my home. They can fly me up and make me roam. I feel the vibrations of the wind. They are chilling the air, but my bones are warm. I fancy. Alabama, Louisiana, Paris, and the swamps. All these places call my name, all these places I call home. There's a secret to them pictures showing everything goes blank. Another one has lived before, we'll do so again. Why fancy? I was born with a common name. Oh, I ain't fancy. Classy white trash, all the same. I ain't fancy.